I'm Ingrid Christiansen. I teach in an urban studies program in Chicago, and I like literature, and I have my background was in literature in school, so I keep returning to literature as a way to understand life, even though I'm doing urban studies more actively these days. Why don't you just say who you are and where you're from?
Okay, I'm Marilyn Robb, and I'm from Vancouver, Washington. Teach fifth grade.
Great.
On staff here this summer. Narnia.
Huh, good.
My name is Michael Brown, and I'm from Benton City, Washington.
Thank you.
An engineer.
An engineer, okay.
I'm Katie Brown, and I'm also from Benton City, and I teach music.
How about you women in the back row by the window?
I'm Nancy Post from Sherman Oaks, California, and I'm a receptionist at the Anglican Church in North Hollywood.
And I'm Cheryl Sawyer from Los Angeles, California. I also go to Emmanuel. I'm a bilingual teacher.
Uh-huh. Good. I'm glad there are a lot of teachers here. This class is going to be an experiment, so it'll be fun for us.
I'm Sue Redka from Hastings, Minnesota, St. Philip's Church, and I'm a French teacher and a homemaker with three children.
Great. How about you two?
Yeah. I'm Peggy Kaufman. Just got my Peggy Kaufman. I work for the St. Paul Schools, St. Paul, Minnesota.
I'm Tom Coffin, and I'm from St. Paul, too.
What do you do, Tom?
I'm an engineer also. I use the best description.
It always interests me when people don't know precisely how to pigeonhole themselves.
Yeah.
Should we start here and go this way?
I'm Jean Markey. I'm from Olympia, Washington, and I'm retired.
Nice.
This is nice. And I'm Linda Allen, Jean's daughter, and I'm
pregnant.
And very pregnant. And I'm a musician. I'm on staff, teaching staff, doing some workshops. I'm a songwriter, storyteller.
Wonderful. Oh, songs. Good. Yes, we should talk.
Mm-hmm. Is this the same name where I'm from?
Yeah, that's right.
I'm Cindy Tapp, and I'm from Hastings, Minnesota. That means I'm one of the pink group.
You're allowed to break out of that identity. Let's start there. What about you?
Jerry DeGraw. I'm also from Hastings.
I'm Kitty DeGraw from Hastings. Susan Cruz from Hastings.
I'm Sarah Pitcher from Holden.
I'm filling in. Who hasn't introduced themselves yet?
I'm Ken Kramer from Longview, Washington.
Great. Well, I'm going to start. Stories, as you know, are ancient. They're intriguing. They're a way we communicate. They're a way we teach our young. They serve lots of functions in our life. I belong to a house church, and I belong to a women's group. My women's group is 19 years old now, and what we mainly do together every other Wednesday is tell each other stories about our lives and help us invent a life that we think rings true and is sensible. John Schramm talked about stories last night in his sermon. He referred to the fact that Jesus answered questions with stories. So Jesus evidently felt that was a good way to teach. And as you know, the Bible's full of stories. Some of them are pretty grim. Especially when I was looking at the Bible stories about parents and children, I ran across things like Job in the Old Testament. So, and the prodigal son. The prodigal son teaches us lots of things. It admits as a commonplace jealousy between siblings, and it talks about defiance and misbehavior among children. I was sort of relieved, actually, to realize that it was documented back that far. Oh, good. Bible children were bad, too. and rebellious and exhibited common sense. You know, the prodigal son said, "This is stupid. I should go home," right? So that story was sort of fun to look at with these kinds of questions in mind. The titles of books, since I've been thinking about trying to use storytelling somehow at Holden, I've been looking. This Norwegian women's fiction book is called An Everyday Story, and the stories in it are just riveting, but they're very commonplace. They're about people's lives. They could be in my women's group. We are the stories we tell. What does it mean that we are the stories we tell? Well, this book, which is a book of the best short stories by North American women since 1945, is stories about commonplaces in their lives. So, American Indian myths and legends. Myths and legends, of course, are stories. And these are categorized by a lot of the sort of main stuff in life. Life and death, creation, family. You know, the stories in here are all things that talk to our life experience. Stories impose order on experience. And when I think about stories, stories have beginnings and middles and ends, and often the end is some kind of a resolution, but it's also a moral or a theme, or we learn something from it that we go on with, that teaches us something. But stories can be do illustrate a point of view. The same story told by two or three different people will teach you very different things and will make you feel different ways. I can tell you a story about a child with a handicap. And the story is that he struggled to get his... Part of his situation is that his teeth are funny, and so he got the money, his parents got the money together, and they went to the dentist, and many fittings and tears and difficulty and awkwardness, and got finally a set of teeth made that would make him look like other children. And he went off to kindergarten with his new teeth, and he came home after just a few days in kindergarten, and his teeth had broken at school. Through no fault of his own, broken biting a banana. What a defeat, you know, and I could leave the story there. But the actual story that I tell about that is a story of a four-year-old making the first phone call of his life, bursting into the house at the end of his morning in kindergarten, saying, "I've got to make a phone call." And I looked at him in surprise, and he climbed up on the stool in the kitchen and said, "Dial Children's Hospital for me." And I did. And he said, "This is Marcus Kretzmann. Could I talk to Dr. Serpak, please?" And Dr. Serpak, Children's Hospital, bless their hearts, are used to children, got Dr. Serpak on the phone. He said, "This is Marcus Kretzmann. In kindergarten this morning, I bit into a banana and my tooth broke off, and I'd like you to fix it today, please." And Dr. Serpak said, "Fine, have your mother bring you in." So two different, I mean, the same story, but two real different feelings about this situation. So they illustrate our feelings about ourselves, our situation. They illustrate how hopeful we are about the outcome. Listen to the stories in my women's group now, when our children are all 13 and 14 and 15, you know, a sense of humor is very important at that point. So they do support a point of view, and they demonstrate truths that we feel in our hearts. They demonstrate truths that we want them to demonstrate. A story doesn't have an objective. The way we tell the story tells the truth that we want it to tell. So we can learn from them. We can learn by the stories that we end up telling about our own lives, how we're feeling, what the underpinnings of our lives are. They can show competence or incompetence, as in the story about the tooth. They can show pathos or strength. They can show love or hate, frustration or solutions to frustrations, hope or hopelessness. But they often, and the ones I like, often end up with illustrating some kind of a theme or a moral. We use stories to teach life skills. We tell each other birth stories. Women love to tell birth stories. And death stories, more and more, unfortunately, now. I think cancer being as commonplace as it is among us, and as at least I'm getting older, I seem to be telling and hearing lots of death stories. And it's helping me. It's helping me because there are going to be some major deaths that I'm going to have to cope with. And so the sort of minor deaths in my life, told and retold through story, I feel preparation or practice or something. I almost don't want to waste the time having us listen to a couple of stories or parts of short bits of stories from other people, but I think maybe I will. This one, American Indian Myths and Legends, has a story about the nature of babies and children that's sort of fun. Glooskap, having conquered the Kiwaku, a race of giants and magicians, and the Medikolan, who were cunning sorcerers, and Pomola, a wicked spirit of the night, besides hosts of fiends, goblins, cannibals, and witches, felt himself great indeed and boasted to a woman that there was nothing left for him to subdue. There you have the framework. You sort of understand who this person is. Glooskap. But the woman laughed and said, "Are you quite sure, master? There is still one who remains unconquered, and nothing can overcome him." In some surprise, Glooskap inquired the name of the mighty one. "He is called Wasis," replied the woman, "but I strongly advise you to have no dealings with him." Wasis was only a baby, who sat on the floor sucking a piece of maple sugar and crooning little songs to himself. Now, Glooskap had never married and was ignorant of how children are managed. But with perfect confidence, he smiled at the baby and asked it to come to him. The baby smiled back, but never moved. Whereupon Glooskap imitated a beautiful bird song. Wasis, however, paid no attention and went on sucking his maple sugar. Unaccustomed to such treatment, Glooskap lashed himself into a rage and in terrible and threatening accents ordered Wasis to come to him at once. But Wasis burst into dire howls, which quite drowned the god's thundering and would not budge for any threats. Glooskap, thoroughly aroused, summoned all his magical powers, resources. He recited the most terrible spells, the most dreadful incantations. He sang the songs which raise the dead and those which send the devil scurrying to the nethermost depths. But Wasis merely smiled and looked a trifle bored. At last, Glooskap rushed from the hut in despair, while Wasis, sitting on the floor, cried, "Goo, goo." And to this day, the Indians say that when a baby says goo, he remembers the time when he conquered the mighty Glooskap. Does that sound familiar in any way? So there's a little story that the Indians are telling. What did we learn from the story? It's an Algonquin tribe, the Passamaquoddy of Maine. Do we learn anything about parenting or about the nature of children or about Hebrews, or, you know, it seems to me there are quite a few things in there that we could learn.
They have a mind of their own.
They do.
They have a lot of power.
Power.
The mind of their own. They, what?
They manipulate.
They manipulate.
It's not really that.
Right. And somehow it doesn't do to do all the things that the god did to try to get the baby. He smiled. He sang a pretty bird song. He ordered, he yelled, he threw a tantrum, he did incantations. I mean, can you remember yourself or other people you know with babies with colic? You would do anything. Incantations is nothing compared to the lengths to which you would go. So there we see the power of a baby. And then one other little bit of a story that I'll read, and then I would like to have us do some stories. This is a story in this book, The Melting Pot, by Lynn Sharon Schwartz, who's a wonderful favorite of mine these days. In this story, the story is entitled What I Did for Love, and it's told from the point of view of a mother and what she did for love was the love of her child, who was around 10 years old. And the story is, I think you you need the title to sort of get it. The title helps. But it has the same deal. It has a frame, and it provides details. After the beginning is a frame, and then there are details, and then there's an end, which has a theme. And this is in contemporary New York. Together with Carl, her husband, I used to dream of changing the power structure and making the world a better place. Never that I could end up watching the 10 o'clock news with a small rodent in my lap. He was the fourth. Percy, the first, was a bullet-shaped dark brown guinea pig, short-haired as distinct from the long-haired kind, and from the moment he arrived he tried to hide, making tunnels out of the newspapers in his cage, until Martine, who was just 8 then, cut the narrow ends off a shoebox and made him a real tunnel, where he stayed, except when food appeared. Percy had been living his hermit life for about a year when Martine noticed he was hardly eating and being unusually quiet, no rustling of paper in the tunnel. I made an appointment with a vet, someone recommended. On the morning of the appointment, after I got Martine on the school bus, I saw Percy lying very still outside the tunnel. I called the vet before I left for work to say I thought his patient might be dead. Might be? Well, how can I tell for sure? He clears his throat and with his patronizing air doctors have, even vets, says, "Why not go and flick your finger near the animal's neck to see if he responds?" Since I work for a doctor, I'm not intimidated by this attitude. It just rolls off me. Okay, hold on a minute. I went and flicked. He doesn't seem to respond, but still, I just don't feel sure. "Raise one of his legs," he says slowly, as if he's talking to a severely retarded person. "Wiggle it around and see if it feels stiff." He never heard of denial, this guy. What am I going to tell Martine? "Hang on." I wiggle the leg. It feels stiff, I had to admit. "I think it's safe to assume," he says, "that the animal is dead." "I guess we won't be keeping the appointment then." I'm not retarded. I said it on purpose to kind of rile him and see what he would say. "That will hardly be necessary." To get ready for the burial, I put Percy in a shoebox, a new one, not the tunnel one, wrapped the tissue paper from the shoes around him and added some flowers I bought on the way home from work, then sealed it up with masking tape. Carl and I kept the coffin in our room that night so Martine wouldn't have to be alone in the dark with it. She didn't cry much, at least in front of us. She keeps her feelings to herself, more like me in that way than Carl. But I knew she was very attached to Percy, hermit that he was. The next morning, a Saturday, the three of us set out carrying the box and a spade and shovel we borrowed from the super of the building. Carl's plan was to bury him in the park, but it was in the dead of winter, February, and the ground was so frozen the spade would hardly break it. "This isn't going to work," he said. Martine looked tragic. She's always been a very beautiful child with a creamy-skinned face and an expression of serene, tragic beauty that, depending on the situation, can make you want to cry or laugh. At this moment, I could have done either. We were huddled together, our eyes and noses running from the cold, Martine clutching the shoebox in her blue down mittens. "I know what," Carl said. "We'll bury him at sea." Martine's face got even more tragic, and I gave him a funny look, too. What sea? It was more than an hour's drive to Coney Island, and I had a million things to do that day. "The river. It's a very old and dignified tradition," he told her, "for people who die on ships when it would take too long to reach land. In a way, it's nicer than an earth burial. In the course of time, Percy's body will drift to the depths and mingle with coral and anemone instead of being confined in..." "Okay," she said. So we walked up to the 125th Street Pier on the Hudson River. This is a desolate place just off an exit on the West Side Highway, where the only buildings are meat processing plants and where in the daytime a few lone people come to wash their cars, hauling water up in buckets, and even to fish, believe it or not. And at night, people come to buy and sell drugs. I looked at Martine. She handed me the box, like she couldn't bear to do it herself, so I knelt down and placed it in the river as gently as I could. I was hoping it would float a while, at least till we could get her away, but my romantic Carl was saying something poetic and sentimental about death, and it began to sink about 4 feet from where we stood. It was headed south, though, towards the Statue of Liberty in the open sea, I pointed out to her, free at last. We got her another guinea pig, a chubby, buff-colored one who did not hide and was intelligent and interested in its surroundings, as much as a guinea pig can be. We must have had it, Mooney it was called, for around a year and a half when Carl began talking about changing his life, finding new directions. He was one of those people, we both were, who had dropped out of school because it seemed there was so much we should be about doing in the world. Then it goes on about that, I should skip that part. And then the last sentence is, in this part of the story, they say, well, anyhow, he never managed to drop back in later on when things changed, not that there was any less to do, but somehow no way of doing it anymore, and hardly anyone left to do it with, not to mention money. You have to take care of your own life, we discovered, and if you have a kid, .. you find yourself doing things you never planned on.
So there are all those details about having to go to the river and where the drug sellers are it's a much longer story about these pets and how she ends up having to care for one that has surgery while her daughter's away at camp and stuff. But what she's done for her children, or for her child, you get the feeling of that this is really, you understand it, all the details and how you can't just dispatch with this thing for an hour in the morning on Saturday. You've got to spend more time and go more at length, and it always is more awkward, and everybody's feelings have to be considered. So it's a nice way of talking about the title, which is What I Did for Love. So what I was going to suggest we do here now is people could take a piece of paper if they wanted, and I'd like you to think of a story about your parenting or your kids or you having been a child with your parents, and think of a way that you would like to tell it. And it would be important for the story to have a beginning and a middle and an end some way, and maybe to have a theme or have that was about an ongoing theme in your family's life, or some kind of a theme that you'd like to highlight, or a moral to the story, something you can learn from it. How whatever it is important in your life, it's illustrative of something that's important in your life. And I thought maybe we'd take 5 minutes for you to jot down some notes about that. If you don't want to do it, don't do it. And then we would listen to as many of them as we have time for. Some storytelling. So anybody who wants paper, I have just a few pens here, but you don't necessarily need to write this down, and you can share pens. And here's some paper. Do you have any questions before you do your assignment? Hearing some of these stories. I'm tempted to say let's hear stories about teens first and then little kids or something like that, but I guess we'll just do random order stories. Who would like to start? Who has a story they can share?
Oh, I'm going to start. Okay. I'm from a different perspective here. I said, since my children are all grown, it is fascinating to note how a story or stories differs with each person's telling. For example, funds were limited, but I felt it was important that each child have a new Easter outfit. My recollection is of sitting up long hours after the children were in bed sewing clothes. My youngest daughter's perspective is entirely different. She explains her aversion to polka dots by explaining she always had a new Easter outfit made with dotted Swiss. Is there a moral there? I don't know. Only a warning to parents. Don't be too complacent about your actions and decisions. In future years, you may discover that they were all wrong.
Boy, that's right. All that work you put into that, and now she... Well, I didn't expect you to have written it out, and you've written it out beautifully. That's wonderful. I thought maybe you'd have a little outline. Great. Yes?
I have a story that illustrates the same point. We lived in a two-bedroom house with a four-year-old girl and a two-year-old boy built in the house. But the two-year-old was still in his crib because there wasn't room for two beds in that room. And so when we built the new house, I very carefully took down his crib and in the best psychological style, I put up the crib in his new bedroom along with his new twin bed we now had room for. And then because we had the luxury of moving out of the house before we sold it, I went back and I had an old crib that had been down at Grandma's house for a while that I carefully set it back up in their bedroom so that I could illustrate that you could get two children in that room. And the first thing that happened was an older couple with no children bought the house. And then we moved into the new house. My son took one look at the twin bed and said, "I'll sleep there, Mom," and never got back in the crib again his entire life. He never seemed to even notice that we'd moved into a new house. It was fine to him. And meanwhile, the cat that I hadn't spent any attention on whatsoever spent a week on the top shelf of the storage closet in the basement, getting down, I think, to go to the bathroom, but I don't think he ate. And I spent this whole time going, "Now, wait a minute. Why did I bother to worry? I worried about the wrong thing, so why bother?"
Can't win. Well, it's nice that your two-year-old did so well.
I have a real short story that shows a child's perspective, I think, and something as our kids have been growing up. If we didn't have money to do something, I'd always say, "Well, kids, it's not that important that you have a lot of money. What's important is the love that we have." I said, "We're the richest folks in town because of all the love we have." And my son was about 4 years old, and he looked up at me with his big blue eyes. He said, "Oh, Mom, poor people must really have a lot of love." Oh, it was just precious that he would be able to think this after what I had told him. It was just beautiful. Mm-hmm. Now when I say that, "Oh, you're not going to talk about that again, are you?" He's older.
How about another story?
Well, I have an 11-year-old story. And my son wanted an earring. And Al and I really didn't like this idea too well. And basically we thought he was pretty young and that it was somewhat of a fad and that he wouldn't get infection and whatever else we could think of and wouldn't be ostracized and everything. Anyway, my way of wanting to deal with it was to be cool and to say, "Oh, well, you know, if you pay for it, Paul, and, you know, if you really wanted that battery and you raised the money, fine." "Well, we'll consider it." Al's solution was, "Well, Paul, if you really want to do this, why don't you, let's talk it over and you go talk to some people about it." And so basically Al prevailed. And we live in an intentional community. So he talked over, and Paul really wanted this, and he just had this burning desire. And so he did go and find about four people within our community, four adults. And he called them up, and he said what he wanted to do. He came over, and he went over and talked with each one of them. And they all told them their views about his getting an earring. He came home and reported. And there were differing views of what he should do, and he still wanted an earring. And his father said, "Fine, now that you've done all of this and you've gone through this process and you've thought about it, I will help you with this, and we'll make the appointment and go get the earring," which they did. And he now has an earring. And I think for me, what was important was I was really upset, mainly because I thought my way was the better way. So, and I kind of just wanted to get one of the women. And I don't think Al did either, really. But what was wonderful for me was that, one, I didn't have the only solution, I thought, and I really appreciated the talking through the whole thing. And that I began to think, well, really, what was the important part here? That this desire was something that was so strong, but was willing to be discussed and to be talked about, and willing to take some responsibility for. He did, by the way. And so I thought, well, okay, I think this was my way, really doesn't have to be the only way to do things. So one is that I kind of like that whole thing. And that he did become very responsible. It was a really good learning experience when he first got his ear pierced, and he really did take care of it. And he wasn't ostracized. He was very, it did create a self-image for him at the time that seemed to have been something he needed to go through. But I think the process of talking it over was good, I thought of myself. It was helpful to me as a parent.
When you've told the story that the sort of semicolon was at the end of, and he did go and get it done, and that was it. And then you went on to talk about the themes and what we can learn out of this. But at the end of that semicolon was very interesting, because I was left with a lot of anxiety about you, which you then immediately addressed. But because you begun the story by saying, I think this is how it should be handled. And then your feelings were contradicted by your spouse, and it was handled a different way. You know, within the telling of the story, you didn't address that, but then you went on sort of in the unpacking of it to address it. Now that left me with a little wrench in my gut right at that point. It's real important what details you include in a story, because you include the details that are important to you.
I was tempted to tell a guinea pig story, because I had a guinea pig in my freezer for 5 months.
Waiting for the ground to fall. People
together. It does take courage.
I'm expecting to come home to a frozen hamster, because it was on its last legs when we left. We couldn't figure out how to tell the neighborhood kids to deal with it. So I said, wrap it in paper towels and put it in the freezer. So do you want to tell a story about...
No, I don't want to tell a story about guinea pig. I want to tell Sarah's story. My daughter Sarah and I married Michael 4 years ago. And his 4 children, including his Sarah. And there's always been a tension. My daughter's very social and loves all of the glamour and excitement of big families. So she goes in between, because we don't always have them all with us. So she gets a little bit of both lives. But when Mike and I were first getting acquainted with each other's children, I remember Sarah Elizabeth, this Sarah, and she came and she popped me on the head. She was 3, and she said, I like you. And my Sarah was, at that time, she was 5, 6. She was different, 5, 6, somewhere in there. And had me alone for a while, and was watching this Nicole very carefully. And I was very intrigued by this 3-year-old and the power that this 3-year-old child had over my older, wiser child. She sat on my lap, the little one sat on my lap, and cuddled me and watched my daughter very carefully And my daughter became more and more upset. And all, you know, what I could do made no difference because this was between the two of them and the things that they were working out together. It was just intriguing to watch the two of them and what they were watching, because Sarah really wasn't watching me, she was watching him to find out what he was doing with my daughter and that they could have sorted out so very quickly in a matter of just a few days where their feelings were and where their priorities were and what they wanted to accomplish and find out about the situation was a wonderful lesson to me, I guess. And over the last 4 years, to have watched them together and their struggles with who they are with each other and who they are with us and the rest of the family, and to watch my daughter. She said to me the other day, we were playing a game that had cards that were supposed to be asked questions in it. It was something about what has come into your life that has been the most important thing, and she said, all those children. And that it's a joyful thing for her, but also a really hard thing.
I'm sure it has. You were probably seeing a little paradigm there that's going to continue in various forms.
There are other stories that I've seen from that first one.
I one time was sitting with my husband's grandmother, who was celebrating her 90th birthday, while her six tall, overweight pastor sons arrived from all over the country, one by one, flew in. And so she would sit, and I was sort of ministering to Oma, and one would come in, Adalbert Raphael came, and Otto Paul came, and no, Martin Luther came, and all these sons. And finally she turned to me and said very quietly, why did I have so many? Reminds me of your daughter, all those kids. I couldn't answer her, of course. How about another story? Uh-huh.
This is about my 8-year-old daughter who was almost 3, Katie. She was in my husband's office at one end of the house while my husband and I were in the kitchen at the other end of the house. Suddenly, Katie came running. Pink Dolly's on fire! My husband went running, picked up the soft sculptured cloth doll and blew out the flame. Katie got her doll too close to the candle. My husband left lit while he came into the kitchen to talk to me. Katie was crying, I was angry, and told her, you know, the dangers of fire. Now I know that was kind of the wrong response. Katie would not settle down. When she saw the doll, she said, throw Pink Dolly away, I don't want her, and buried her head in my chest. And Daddy said, no, Pink Dolly is hurt. We don't throw you away when you're hurt. Well, maybe Mommy can put a bandage on her head. So I sewed a white cloth over the melted burnt part and tried to give Katie back her doll. She would not even look at it. We told her she needed to make her baby a special hospital bed, and the infant seat in her room did nicely. She finally put the doll in the bed and covered it up, but it was several days before she would even pick up the doll again. Well, that experience instilled a fear of fire. A few months later, the toaster burned or caught fire. I quickly put it out, but of course Katie was scared. And even for the next 2 years, whenever there was an encounter with a fire, either in a story or in a movie, she would respond the same way. She was almost, well, she had just turned 5, and we took her to the American Tale, the story of American Tale. And in 10 minutes into the movie was a scene about the fire, the house catching fire with the mice in it. Again, she was got scared, even hysterical, and we had to take her out of the movie. Luckily, we got our money back. But we didn't know what to do, you know, because this fear was still so strong. But I think she conquered some of that fear after she entered kindergarten. Because during, I don't know if it was fire prevention week or whatever the occasion, she brought that pink dolly to show and tell and told about it. And I remember her teacher saying during a conference, you know, how, you know, she told about the doll and we pulled the bandage back so the children could see where it had burned. And after that, she seemed to settle down. Now Katie is 8, so there isn't that, you know, response in her. But as something that she probably will remember for the rest of her life.
Well, that's a really powerful story. What are some of your reactions to that? It was such thoughtful parenting. It took the incident real seriously, but it made her feel responsible. But it also taught her the seriousness of fire, and then it healed her, but it took a while. You really worked at the healing. You know, she had done something that frightened her and she knew was scary and she felt bad about. And then you worked it through until she, you didn't let it go. You stayed with it until it healed.
You know, but again, I think we gave the wrong response. You know, we were again really angry at her after the, having to leave the movie early. But see, we weren't dealing with her fear. We were angry because we had to leave after, you know, she wanting to go to it. And then again, we were angry to begin with when she first left the doll there. I didn't say that she, after the doll caught fire, she had left it down on my husband's daytime booklet, you know, his appointment book, which had a book of matches on top of it besides. So it could have ended up in a real serious fire. But luckily the doll was probably fireproofed, and so it just more or less smoldered.
Of course, none of the rest of you have ever gotten angry out of fear, right? It's that rush of anger that comes when you realize that the terrifying possibility has been conquered and you're safe. Then the release of anger, I don't know why that's built into us, but it's so powerful and it really affects both our kids and us, I think. You can't blame yourself for that. She could have, I mean, the possibility.
She could have ran and hide and who wouldn't even know that her doll was burning in the bathroom.
I think she probably wouldn't be just fine about fire at age 8 if you hadn't continued to...
Even now, when we have devotions and she wants to light the candle, she really doesn't want to strike a match. Yeah. So I still think she's working through it, but yes, she's overcome some of that fear.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any stories about teenagers?
I do. I'm not sure what the plot is or what the moral is. There's possibly two.
I wrote down
a title is all I could write down. And it says, since I was a mother, since I've been a mother, I've hated Mother's Day. And this is a Mother's Day story. When our daughter was 18, and any of you that have had 18-year-old kids, you know how delightful they are. There's nothing more than that. But Mother's Day happened to come on the day after the
big high school prom. And so much effort and time had gone into preparing for the prom. You know, the money involved in the dress and all of the stuff that goes with that. And a lot had been given, but Mother's Day was the next day, and I was looking forward to that, hoping that something wonderful would happen. And knowing that probably it wouldn't, I sort of padded the day, and I had bought tickets for our family to all go to a musical that afternoon. And so I thought, well, if nothing else happens, at least we'll have a nice afternoon together. And I had hoped for the whole family attending church together. But our daughter had gone to the prom and had spent the night with a friend and was sleeping in and did not come home in time to go to church, which hurt a little bit, a lot, hurt a lot. And the play, I think, started about 2 in the afternoon, and so we called where she was staying and said, you know, we would pick you up. And of course, this time, I was feeling quite angry. I was not worth enough to even come home and go to church with as a family. So we went by the friend's house and picked her up. And of course, she had gotten up probably 10 minutes before we came by and came rushing out and was going to be the dutiful daughter and go to the family outing, to the play with the family. But of course, she made it very obvious that she would rather not have been with us, would have rather slept in. Proceeded to tell us that what a wonderful family she had spent, where she had spent the night, what a wonderful family they were, that she and the girl that she had spent the night with had gotten up and sat on the bed with the parents, had sat on the bed with the mother and the man who was in bed with her, which turned out to not be the father, but she made my husband and I feel really bad that, you know, we didn't sit up late at night and have her and her girlfriend come in and sit on the bed and talk to us and all this sort of thing. And she went on and on about how wonderful it was to come into the bedroom where these people were and talk about the date and talk about the good time they'd had and all this sort of thing. But it turned out to be, you know, a very hurtful day. Even going to the play was not a very pleasant experience, because I was more or less on Mother's Day being told that I wasn't a good mother. Well, there were two endings to the story. One, when we got home from the play, I left and went on strike because my family had done nothing for Mother's Day. The only celebration we had was going to the play that I had bought the tickets for and everything. And I was very hurt, and so I went on strike for about a week. And we celebrated Mother's Day the following Sunday. My son, 16-year-old son and 18-year-old daughter and husband got together and didn't provide a very nice day the following Sunday. But I managed to stay on strike for a week. The second ending to the story is our daughter, who's now 22 and a sociology major in college, is constantly coming up with, gee, you and Dad did a wonderful job, and, you know, what you did was right, and all this sort of thing. And of course, it turned out that this couple that she thought were the parents that were in bed happened to be the guy who was just spending the night, and, you know, it was not a good family situation at all. But just the two endings to the story, one that I went on strike, and I still don't care for Mother's Day very much, but I did have a nice Mother's Day celebration a week later. And the other ending is that now, and the more important ending is that, you know, in her growing up, she has seen that what we did as parents, what we were able to do as parents, you know, we were able to provide a strong background and a good relationship. And just because we weren't up late at night, we were sleeping, you know, we did have a strong family background, and there were other things more valuable. But raising an 18 is a terrible age. I mean, it's 18-year-olds are tough sometimes. Well, I'm sure we're all glad to hear that.
I was just about to tell a story about a 17-year-old. I'm not sure the ending doesn't sound like it's going to be too good.
The endings are good. The endings were both good.
If you wait long enough.
Well, that's important to note. I think, I mean, certainly for parenting, you get some kind, different kinds of rewards along the way, but you also have to put up with a lot. It's hard, and it's miserable sometimes. You have to hope that the adult that you end up with is going to be someone that you like.
Especially, I think, when you're, you know, you think you've done the right thing up to that point, and an 18-year-old is going to challenge what you've done. And then it seems when they get beyond that, they say, wow, you were right all along.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that. That is a hard story. Interesting story. I imagine those two beautiful 18-year-old girls in their prom dresses were sort of entertainment for the visiting man.
Yeah, I don't know. On the end of the bed, yeah, I don't know. But being told about this wonderful family and then finding out a couple of weeks later that the wonderful family was mother and whoever spent the night.
So. Well, maybe we should end, or we might have a little more time, but how about the story about the 17-year-old?
Well, I have a 17-year-old son. Actually, his birthday was yesterday, and he's not here. He's at home. In the process of leaving to get ready to come, I had to negotiate around his medication. He has asthma, and he's had it for a long time. He's been on numerous medications for a long time. And the whole thing about him being 17 is that, like, next year he's going to go away to college, and he's got to take over all of this responsibility and so on. And I've let him go to the doctor by himself this year, and he's really learned a lot about having asthma, and he knows how to handle it, but I can't get out of it yet, you know? So I'm still putting the medicine out on the counter, and actually it's in a week-long thing, and then he takes over. You know, I fill it up, and it's there. But in order to leave, I put backup medication in the cupboard, and, you know, as we're getting ready to go, I'm saying, now, David, you know that there's extra inhalers up here and medicines up here. Mother, I know where you keep my medicine. You know? And I even went so far as to ask his dad if he knew how to order extra medicine, because I've always done that. You know, and it's I just realized how hard it's going to be to back off and let him go. And it's just symbolic of the whole letting go. You know, I mean, there's other parts of his life that are going to, you know, that we will also be out of. But the only problem with the asthma is that kids who have asthma, and if people have had it for a long time, they tend to minimize symptoms as they come. And so there have been some deaths in our community, which is kind of unusual with asthma, where kids who didn't, people didn't seek help soon enough. And he sees himself as highly controlled, and he knows exactly when to do what. But that's my fear. You know, when he's gone and I can't be the one who listens and says, I hear you wheezing or, you know, whatever, that he will do something soon enough to take care of the problem. And I think he will. Intellectually he knows, but he's also into, I don't need help, I don't need anybody, so, you know, maybe he would get to the point of going, why should I go to the doctor, I'll handle it myself, when he, you know, and him knowing that point. And that's why I don't know the end of the story, because it's like, this 2 weeks he's handling it, and we'll see what happens. But
well, it'd be interesting at the end of these 2 weeks, uh-huh. For you.
And he'll probably be just fine. You know.
But will he be just fine, and will he insist on autonomy then and say, I'll take it from now on, Mom? Mm-hmm. Or sometimes we've had groups up at Holden on parenting children with disabilities and sicknesses. Mm-hmm. Might be fun to pull one together this week. If you think there's an interest, we would be happy to do that. I'm always interested in that subject. Is there another story somebody could tell?
I'm sure mine begins with a question, a couple of questions. I am not a parent, so I can't tell the story from that perspective, but can talk a little bit about my own childhood. The formal record shows that I grew up on a family farm 10 miles out from a rather small town. And I remember there was a lot of work. But what's missing, and perhaps radically so, is any memory of any experience of being in any relationship with my parents. I can begin to recall some things in senior high school that my parents said or did, or, but very limited then also. And I often wonder why this is. And today I'm strongly committed to values of personal honesty and dependability and a very demanding style of self-discipline. But where did I learn this? I do remember one incident in my high school years when two of my classmates invited me out to a fish house for an overnight on Little Bemidji Lake in northern Minnesota. I was a babe in the woods, very naive. They were planning a drunken deal, a drunken overnight, and I had no inkling what it was. I thought we were going fishing. But they got to drinking, and it was very clear in my mind I didn't want anything to do with that. And I can remember watching them stumble around that fish house with a gas lantern for light and that. And the question of drinking alcoholic beverages has never been an issue to me. I've just been very clear in my mind, just don't do it. But going back to my earlier childhood, where did I learn this? And I guess it's, I end my story with a question to the parents here, is how are your children learning these values, and are they able to recall the learning experiences of establishing these primary lifelong values, if you will?
Thank you. Somebody said to me once, you can't decide, you can't make your kid turn out a certain way, you can't form them or make them strong in certain areas, but you can easily ruin them.
But I think his story illustrates something about stories, though, because I think most of my memories of my early childhood are not so much of the actual happening as of the retelling.
Yes.
And that's something that I've tried to make sure happens in my own home, is the retelling of certain little incidents that speak of the uniqueness of our family.
In fact, that's advice they give you in almost all books on developmental issues with kids, is tell them the stories of their years and of their family's years and their heritage. Well, I think you'll all be interested to hear that there's a whole set of little people up here listening to this discussion. But thank you all very much. This was fun. I appreciate all the storytelling that you did today.